Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest bombshell from the Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, who, after repeating the talking points of GOP candidates and Republican lawmakers, echoed their determination to outlaw abortion, then added that if abortion is outlawed in this country, women who end pregnancies should face punishment. Then, after a firestorm of criticism from abortion supporters and opponents, Trump quickly amended his position, saying that states should handle the issue and that doctors who performed abortions should be held legally responsible. Jo Freeman, a feminist political scientist, writer, and attorney, joins us to discuss the outrage on both the pro-life and pro-choice sides over Trump's remarks, which highlight the fact that in many countries, women are imprisoned for having abortions. And if abortion was to be outlawed in America, many men and women would go to jail. Then we will discuss the PBS Frontline documentary, Saudi Arabia Uncovered, and speak with one of the participants in the film, Ali Al-Ahmed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. He is an expert on Saudi political affairs, Saudi-American relations, the ruling Al-Saud family, and Wahhabi Islam. And we will discuss the portrait of a country which is an ally, but is as repressive, if not more, than our enemy North Korea, and the recent kidnappings of dissident Saudi princes in Europe. Then finally, we'll look into the fourth nuclear security summit that President Obama is convening, which Russian President Putin is boycotting, and speak with Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He joins us to discuss where progress stands on securing nuclear material, given the determination of terrorists to get hold of it, and what can be done to secure Pakistan's growing nuclear arsenal in a country where the government cannot protect its own citizens from terrorism. And joining us now is Jo Freeman, who's an American feminist, political scientist, writer, and attorney. She has also written extensively about women, particularly on law and public policy towards women and women in mainstream politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jo Freeman.
Thank you, and just glad to be here.
And in terms of Donald Trump's remarks to Chris Matthews today, which got a lot of attention, and then he had, within a couple of hours, he had to backpedal and revise them. One of the things I find ironic, which I mentioned in the opening, is that in many countries, women do go to prison, to this very day, go to prison for having abortions. And furthermore, all Trump was saying was essentially what the GOP position is and has been and is fervently held by them, which is they are determined to outlaw abortion in this country. So isn't it logical that if you outlaw abortion in this country, it's against the law, won't people go to jail? Go ahead.
Certainly some people will go to jail if you make it against the law, and they did back in the day when it was against the law. It's just a matter of which people. And I think the GOP is trying to say that it's the abortion providers and not the women who would go to jail, but I wouldn't assume that will be true. That could very well be wishful thinking. I can think of a few states in which the legislatures would be quite happy to pass laws making it criminal for a woman to have an abortion.
Well, most laws do have kind of tangential laws associated with the conspiracy laws, for example. So if you're in the presence of a commission of a crime, you're liable. So it's highly likely that if abortion is banned in this country and outlawed, then not only would doctors be held responsible, but those around them would as well. I mean, I'm not defending what Donald Trump said, and I'm not sure he knows what he said and knows the consequence of it. But I don't think he's thought things through particularly. But it is ironic, isn't it, that all of these right-wing Republican anti-abortion people were hysterical about his remarks, including Ted Cruz, when in fact he was actually speaking truthfully, if not not knowing what he was saying.
I think you're right about that. As you know, Donald Trump was once pro-choice. Now he's decided he's pro-life, except that he wants to punish everyone who might have an abortion. My own reading of the Donald is he doesn't know or care much about the issue of abortion. It's just not something he wants to be concerned about. And therefore, he will articulate whatever position he thinks his audience wants to hear. And when he was a real estate developer in New York, which is a liberal state, New York City, where most people are pro-choice, he was pro-choice. Now that he's running in the Republican primary, where conservative voters don't like abortion, he doesn't like abortion. So I think it fits his position to the circumstances. I don't think he knows much or cares much one way or the other. It does reflect his attitude toward women, however, and I think that's really much more important than his actual words on abortion. Trump is misogynist par excellence, and he has this lengthy history of dominating women, putting women down, putting them in their place, punishing them. Basically, his idea of a good woman is someone who stands in front of him admiringly, gazing into his eyes, and serves him as he pleases. And that's out of step with the times. I don't think even the Republican women believe that that's a woman's place anymore.
Well, he certainly has an adoring wife. I believe she's the fourth so far.
Yes.
And he has, of course, he ran that beauty pageant thing for the longest time, and apparently mm-hmm. is given to rating women, you know, that she, 1 to 10, you know, she's a 6, she's a 10, she's a 7. So I imagine there are a lot of women that don't appreciate those numerical
categories. He does more than that. First of all, he gets rid of women who become too independent or too old. That's why he's on wife number 4. It's not too surprising. And secondly, from my memory of his running of the beauty pageants, he didn't just pick the beauties. He humiliated women. I mean, that's what he gave him his kicks. It wasn't just if he was the man in charge, is that he could take women who wanted to be appreciated and make them feel really lousy. That's what he gets off on.
So again, I'm speaking with Jo Freeman, who's an American feminist, political scientist, writer, and attorney. She has written extensively about women, particularly on law and public policy towards women and women in mainstream politics. But just to follow up on what I was suggesting in many ways that Trump was accidentally speaking truth about the real consequences of outlawing abortion in this country, just to put it in some global context here, in El Salvador, which has one of the harshest abortion bans in the world, and women are routinely prosecuted for illegally ending a pregnancy, and some women are serving decades behind bars for having a miscarriage that authorities suspect was in fact induced. In Ecuador, women are convicted of ending a pregnancy. They can face up to 5 years in prison. In the state of Guanajuato in Mexico, they've criminalized abortion. Women have been sentenced up to 30 years in prison, and at least 17 women are serving time there in next door in Mexico. And then, of course, in the Philippines, women can face up to 6 years in prison for an abortion. So it's not unheard of. And, of course, it wasn't that long ago in the United States that women were abortion was illegal, and not only were women dying from back alley abortions, were they also held criminally liable?
Yes, they were held criminally liable, but I don't think you saw sentences like the ones you just described in El Salvador and Mexico and the Philippines. And we do have a criminal justice system, which with all its flaws, works with a little more justice in terms of determining culpability. So the women in El Salvador, where it wasn't even very clear that they had intended that their pregnancies end, I don't think we'd go that far. Our criminal justice system, with all its flaws, is better than that. So, but yes, is it possible for women to go to jail for having an abortion? Yes. There are some states that I think would do that.
Well, I wasn't suggesting that that's about to happen here in the United States, but it is a fact. It happens around the world. Let's turn then to Donald Trump's problem with women, which I don't think he's done himself any favors with his remarks to Chris Matthews today. which, of course, he rapidly rescinded or tried to revise. He's really way down in the polls across the board, and even among Republican women. So who is supporting him? I know when we last spoke, you had written a piece about how, in many ways, women are behind the Tea Party. So he's pretty much a Tea Party candidate. So where is his support amongst women?
Well, I haven't read any polls recently which broke it out. Clearly, I mean, there are some women who support him. I mean, you know that, and I know that. But, you know, on percentage-wise, it's definitely lower than men or equivalent men. But let's put Donald Trump into context, though. He was born in 1947. I was born in 1945, so he's my generation. I know the cohort from which he came. I'm sorry, he was born in 1946. Hillary was born in 1947. Let me excuse that. And then Bernie Sanders was born in 1941. So we're sort of all of the same cohort. That generation of men was raised to believe that a woman's place was serving her husband and taking care of her children. And she really had no other claim to existence beyond that. That's what Trump was raised to believe. Now, when the women's movement emerged in the late 60s, initially, even progressive left-wing men didn't see the light. But most of them came around. And I can't tell you where Bernie was at. I don't know his personal background well enough to know whether he was good on women from the beginning or whether he changed his mind, as so many men did. Trump didn't. Trump grew up in an era in which men dominating women was considered the norm, and he's continued to do that all his life. He carries it a step further. He doesn't just want to dominate women, he wants to humiliate women, and he does that repeatedly, like he did with Megyn Kelly. It explains why he sees nothing wrong with his staff member grabbing that female reporter and bruising her arm. He just doesn't see anything wrong with it. I mean, those two women, those two reporters were just out of place. Of course they should be put back in their place. It's how he thinks. There is a whole strata of men who agree with that. And they are among his most ardent supporters. They tend to be older. The younger generation has been changing over time. But these older men were raised to believe that a woman's place is serving them. And when Trump does these things, it reinforces their beliefs and makes them feel that they're right.
So let's turn to a broader issue then in this election. And clearly, Trump is the front runner, although the next vote primary is in a week from yesterday in Wisconsin. And Ted Cruz is ahead, I think, by about 10 points now over Trump. And there's no question that the Republican establishment is piling on. They're just doing everything. They're pulling out all the stops. They really want to stop this guy. They're making it real clear that this guy is going to be a disaster for the Republican Party, that the down-ballot effect could be catastrophic for them, that they could lose the Senate, and they might even lose the House if he's the head of the ticket. So there's no mystery that the Republicans do not want this guy as their nominee, but he's closer to the nomination than any of the other candidates. So why is it that while the Republicans are piling on against Trump, why are the Democrats piling on against him as well? Shouldn't they want him to be the nominee? Because if the Republicans hate this guy so much and think he's a disaster, doesn't that tell you something?
Yeah, it tells you quite a bit. Well, let me answer you this way. Last fall, when Trump first started making headlines, I was actually cheering him on because I thought he was God's gift to the Democratic Party. But as he has won primary after primary after primary, I am beginning to have second thoughts. I'm beginning to get a little worried that maybe he's tapping into some dark vein in American society that's bigger than I thought it was, and it scares me. And, you know, I've read enough history to know that populists emerge every now and then. And when populists can get a massive following, they can wreak great havoc. I can just talk about different populists. George Wallace, back in my day. Tom Watson, back at the turn of the 20th century. I mean, I could go on. There are lots of them. I could mention several. They can wreak great havoc. And Trump seems to be tapping into a larger segment, of the American population than I thought would believe what he says, and it scares me. So it's possible that the Democratic Party is equally worried that this segment might cause some great harm.
So what then do you make of the polls that say that Bernie Sanders could beat Trump more soundly than Hillary Clinton?
Well, I'm glad Bernie can beat Trump. That makes me feel a lot better. Okay, but you know there are some similarities between Bernie and Trump, and I say that cautiously because I happen to like Bernie Sanders, but they're both populist in their own way. What populists do is they appeal to the hopes and fears of the American public rather than their realistic assessment of what's doable and what's desirable. And populists of the past have raised the crowd by articulating hopes and fears. The big difference between both Bernie and the Donald do that. The big difference between them is that Trump appeals primarily to people's fears, with a little toss to hope, and Sanders appeals primarily to people's hope, with a little toss to fear, which is why it's much easier to like Bernie Sanders than it is Donald Trump. But they do have the same appeal. So that section of the population, and especially the white working class population, which has felt angered and alienated and left out, finds something attractive in this. It finds them articulating what they believe or what they hope or what they want. Some of them are drawn to the fear and some of them are drawn to the hope. There's another big difference between them, and I think this is important. Bernie Sanders speaks truth to power. Donald Trump speaks power to truth. He stands for the proposition that if you're dominant enough and powerful enough, you can impose your will on everything around you, and it doesn't matter what the truth is. And again, there's a section of the U.S. population, very heavily older white men, but not exclusively, which likes that. It makes them feel like their lives have meaning. It expresses their anger and their alienation and makes them believe that, yes, he has the power and he can do this. He can put women back in their place. He can kick the immigrants out. I find that scary. I find that really scary. Bernie makes a different kind of appeal. He appeals to those people who want the economy to work for them again, and he articulates ways in which he says that can be done. They're just not very realistic ways. Okay, that's the difference between him and Hillary. Hillary is a realistic politician, and hope often gets a better audience than realism.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Joe Freeman. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, I enjoyed the talk.
I did too. And again, I've been speaking with Joe Freeman, who's an American feminist, political scientist, writer, and attorney. She has written extensively about women, particularly on law and public policy towards women and women in mainstream politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into Saudi Arabia and the recent kidnappings of dissident Saudi princes in Europe.
It has always been around. It will always have a niche. But they'll make it a privilege, not a right, accessible only to the rich. Hey, pro-lifers need to dig themselves, because life don't stop after birth. And for a child born to the unprepared, it might even just get worse. The situation would surely change if they were to find themselves in it.
supporters of the H-bomb and firebombing clinics.
ضحك علي بعيونهم نوى النظرة رماني ثم ضحك علي نوى النظرة رماني جيتني بجوز عيونه على صمار الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ali Alamed, who is the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. He's a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family history. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Alamed.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Ali, you're featured in the Frontline, the PBS Frontline documentary last night, Saudi Arabia Uncovered. And it was the first time, I think, that anybody has seen what goes on inside Saudi Arabia, because you cannot film in there. And these were surreptitiously filmed, hidden cameras by some very brave young Saudis to give us a window into this country. And frankly, it is I have never seen anything like this. Truly has to be the most repressive country on earth. It's going to talk about the Republic of Fear, which was how Saddam Hussein's Iraq was described. This is completely held together by oppression and fear. And in many ways, the fact that this country is an ally, it seems to me more as oppressive, if not more repressive, than our enemy, North Korea.
Absolutely. I think what you've seen in this program really gives a small representation of what takes place in Saudi Arabia. This is a regime. It's a monarchy, an absolute monarchy, in a region that holds the largest concentration of absolute monarchies. That's the Gulf countries. And the GCC governments, all absolute monarchies, are supported by the United States and other major Western governments. And that is the disturbing part. You might not blame the monarchies that much. They want power. They want to loot that oil. But when you talk about Western democratically elected regimes that supports these absolute monarchies, the United States in particular, a government that was established after throwing or liberating itself from an absolute monarchy, is now the number one supporter and guarantor of security and survival of the largest collection of absolute monarchies. That's very, very odd. What you've seen in terms of executions, poverty, the repression, we've been saying that for many years. And you're absolutely right about it's hard to film there. In that country, it's illegal to film in the street, and you may go and you may end up in jail, just like that policeman who filmed and distributed the execution of that woman in public. This is really a country that deserves the title the Kingdom of Silence. It is the modern Iron Curtain, and even more so than maybe North Korea in many ways.
Well, the other disturbing, I mean, there are many disturbing aspects to this Frontline special on Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia Uncovered, and obviously it was played last night, and anybody can pick it up online. But it's what's continuing and what has caused the situation in the country today and continues is how the mindset is poisoned from cradle to grave by Wahhabism, the version of Islam that's the official Saudi version, which they've exported around the world with enormous amounts of petrodollars. You have scenes in the film where they get inside a big mosque, a main mosque in Riyadh, where the preacher the sermon is, you've got to, it's your duty to kill the Jews and kill the Christians. And then you have another scene in the film where a young school kid, I think he's about 10 or 12 years old, is studying his textbooks, and the textbooks say that it is your duty to kill Jews and Christians. I mean, this is what how can our diplomats, and by the way, our president is going to meet in Riyadh. He's going to a summit on April the 21st, only, what, 3 or 4 weeks away. He's going to be sitting down with these people who, you know, show one face to the West and another face to their own people.
Absolutely. I have worked on the issue of Saudi school books and their teachings for over 14 years at least. And I've spoken to American officials, the State Department, and to my dismay, the reaction has been very negative, to the degree that the former ambassador at large for religious freedom was lying to Congress about this and defending the Saudis on the issue of textbooks. And the stuff that the Saudi textbooks, even the Nazis did not advocate such a thing. For example, there are two lessons that says that every Jew on earth should be killed and murdered. Jews didn't say that. I mean, sorry, the Nazis didn't say that even in their school books. And yet, American officials were dodging this issue. They didn't want to use any solution. To the degree 10 years later, I said, you know, you've been doing this for 10 years and it didn't work. It's time to change your policies. And, of course, they didn't. And that's why you still have these teachings that are producing. The Saudi school books are producing the greater number of terrorists than probably anything else. It's not the wars. It's not whatever in the news. It is school books because, like you said, that child who is 11 years old learns this at a young age. For 12 years, if you are fed this toxic ideology, you at least 1 to 5% of those people will carry on the message. You know, that's enough. Out of 6 million Saudi students, if you talk about 1 to 5%, you're talking about from 50,000 to 250,000, and that's way more than anyone can deal with. So, really, this issue of textbooks, the Saudi religious establishment and its toxic ideology about not only Jews and Christians but about the rest of the world and about other Muslims is the genesis of ISIS and any of these terrorist movements that kill on identity.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Alamed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. He's a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family history. And we're talking about the PBS Frontline documentary, Saudi Arabia Uncovered, which Ali Alamed is in the documentary, he's featured in it. And it gives, for the first time, a look inside what apparently is the most oppressive country on earth. Now, one of the explanations for why U.S. officials have turned a blind eye and made excuses for Saudi Arabia for so long, and yet they've, you know, we've had this whole war on terror, and after all, Bin Laden was a Saudi. 15 of the 19 that flew into the World Trade Center and blew up the Pentagon and tried to blow up the Capitol were Saudi citizens. The evidence is extraordinary. All the problems we've had in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, all around the world, have their fingerprints and roots go back to Saudi Arabia. But yet we know that they have the oil. So not that that's an excuse, but that's a reason. But the other factor, the reason why we turn a blind eye, is that almost every congressman of any importance, every top CIA, State Department official of any importance, when they retire, end up on the Saudi payroll. Unlike AIPAC, which is a powerful lobby Americans who support Israel, a lot of people say, well, the Saudis have got plenty of money. Well, this is how they spend their money. they buy our officials.
Yeah, the Saudi government and the Saudi monarchy, I would say, has invested and spent hundreds of millions of dollars in Washington and across the United States in various ways to buy influence, and that's not a secret. And it has been allowed to do so and for many, many, many decades, and allowing it to escape even U.S. laws domestically. If you look at the aftermath of September 11, the only people who were allowed to fly while even U.S. senators were not allowed to fly were Saudi nationals who were requested by the Saudi government to fly out of the United States. And that shows you the influence of money over U.S. politics, and that's really the saddest thing in this country is when you if you have the money and you can pay, you can get anything basically done. And that's how the Saudis figured it out. My fear is that the Chinese will figure this out and the Russians. It's not really about the oil in particular, because Canada exports more oil to the United States. Venezuela exports more oil to the United States. But it's about those personal relationships. Politicians, many, maybe most in this country, they operate on money. And selfish motives are, I think, the strongest motives in human beings, especially financial motives. And I think the Saudis have figured that out. And we know, we can give examples of Carter to Clinton to others who have been basically funded and given money so they can change their positions. And that's unfortunate reality that the American people maybe should work to take back their country and prevent their politicians from selling their national interest for in exchange of financial gains.
Well, Ali Alamed, the documentary that you're in, that Frontline documentary, Saudi Arabia Uncovered, the writer, director, producer is a British filmmaker, James Jones, and he came to the project because he got hold of this secret footage of the Saudi blogger who was flogged in the square and is still in prison and has been given some outrageous prison sentence. But what's interesting about James Jones is that the previous film he made for Frontline was based on secret footage smuggled out of North Korea. So the analogies are not inaccurate. He basically, you know, this is the sequel to North Korea.
It's not much different than North Korea. In fact, if you compare the two, there is a lot of similarities in terms of the succession, that it's in the family. And I always mock those pro-Saudi American analysts when they say, oh, stability and succession in Saudi Arabia is very important. And I say, well, that's exactly what you have in North Korea. It's the same exact way of doing things. In North Korea, although they have nuclear bombs and they talk a lot of a lot of smack, as they say in America, but they have not supported terrorism across the globe. They have not. They were not North Koreans who bombed this country on September. They were Saudis and many other Americans who have been killed, and many other nationalities who have been killed were killed by Saudi terrorists and suicide bombers. None were killed by North Koreans. That's not to absolve the North Korean regime, but if you compare the two, I think on international peace, so the Saudi monarchy has posed a greater threat. The bombings in Belgium, France, the United Kingdom, in Iraq, Tunisia, you can trace another country. You can trace those to the Saudi state-sponsored religious ideology that is Wahhabism, that is the sort of that violent and almost nihilistic ideology that the Saudi government proudly supports.
Well, the film, the dissidents that risk their lives, you don't get much of a portrait of them because they're hidden, but you get a sense of the dangers. But you also see a lot of footage of big protests in the East. There's Shia uprisings, particularly when they executed Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, and also protests all across Saudi Arabia that are violently put down. So there is an impression that even though the authorities, the royal family that just basically run the whole show, and they keep everybody distracted with all this religious repression via the Wahhabism, where you know, they're totally preoccupied with how they look and one wisp of hair and some guy comes in a, into a shopping mall and beats you up. That's a lot to handle. But on the other sort of double barrel, if you will, of repression is the Saudi state itself, which will just jail anybody that shows any slight hint of criticism. I think I don't know whether it's a hanging or an executable offense, that criticizing the king, but apparently you can be put away for a long time for whatever they decide is criticism of the king. So is that place a powder keg? It doesn't seem like, it doesn't feel like to me that it can survive much longer in the real world.
I agree that the Saudi model of government cannot survive the modern age. And it's a regime that's constructed for the old times, and it has been propped up because of the oil and because of the Western support. In the past 11 months, the U.S. alone sold nearly $100 billion worth of arms to the Gulf countries, mostly Saudi Arabia, and provided support and continues to provide the support. I mean, I have former FBI directors or assistant directors who said that, yeah, we support them, even against you people who want to establish democracy. They admitted it. They didn't mince a word about it. So the Western support and protection has provided a lot of, gave the Saudi monarchy life and continue, I think, is... it's not on life support yet, but without the Western support, and I said that in the documentary, the Saudi regime would have collapsed many years ago. That hopefully will change when the Western government will stop supporting and protecting and ensuring the survival of the Saudi monarchy. In terms of the protests, just a few hours ago, there were protests after a young man was arrested and beaten to death by the Saudi monarchy police 20 days ago, and his body was held for 20 days. Yesterday, there was another young man, a black man this time, who was unfortunately very similar to the American street scenes where a black man was murdered and openly by police for doing nothing. So there is protest, continues to be protest, although some media in the West say the Arab Spring has not arrived to the Gulf of Saudi Arabia. Mm. But there are protests, but there is also a media blackout against these protests. So really what PBS did is an honorable thing when they brought this film and they featured it in their one of their flagship programs.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Ali Alamed, there are a number of dissident princes who've gone to Europe. This young king, the real king, the son of the king, Salman, who's running the kingdom, this 30-year-old, who's a hardcore Wahhabi, completely inexperienced. He's got him into a war in Yemen. They're bogged down. They're hemorrhaging money. There's a lot of dissent within the Saudi Al Saud royal family. Of course, there are thousands of these princes, many of them in Europe. Recently, a number have been kidnapped. One was on his way to Morocco, and they turned the plane around and brought him back. What happens to these dissident princes when they get returned to Saudi Arabia?
Many of them, basically disappear for many years, and we don't hear anything about them. But typically, none of them have been tortured or jailed. In normal jails. In fact, the Saudi ruling family never puts its princes in jail. They put them in villas, even if these people who killed, we have cases of members of the ruling family who have killed. King Salman have a famous saying in Arabic that our kids will never face our sword, meaning that they will never, the normal justice system will not apply to them. And that has been always something that they have made sure they're almost sacred above the law, if you may. But that's not the case for the former or the daughters of the late King Abdullah, four daughters who have been basically put away for more than 14 years now. They have been missing since their father died, and they were held against their will for since 2001. So we don't know anything about them. So. They do put their own, punish them for threatening the monarchy. And in this case, Sultan bin Turki and others, some of them whom I know personally, so they were fighting over the spoil of the monarchy, not in terms of supporting or defying the monarchy. These are not rebel princes who want to the monarchy to disappear. They just want a larger piece of the cake. So this is very common. The kidnapping is very common. And what is disturbing is that these countries, where like the Swiss and the French and others, who these people were kidnapped from, have not raised it and considered it to be a crime. And that's really the sad part.
Well, Ali Al-Ahmed, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, sir.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Al-Ahmed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. He's a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al-Saud family history. And he appeared in the PBS Frontline special last night inside Saudi Arabia Uncovered. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into President Obama's convening the fourth and last nuclear summit in Washington.
The Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole list truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joseph Cirincione, who is the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations, and served as the staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cirincione.
Ian, thank you very much for having me on.
And Joe, this is, of course, the fourth and last nuclear summit, the nuclear security summit that President Obama is convening tomorrow evening, I believe it starts. Last time there were 47 heads of state. I believe there'll be fewer, and a very conspicuous absence will be President Vladimir Putin of Russia. What do you make of his absence?
Well, it's a major blow to the summit, actually. You know, most of the nuclear materials that we're talking about, the highly enriched uranium and plutonium, the stuff of nuclear bombs, the stuff we're trying to control, is held by the United States and Russia. So when one of the largest holders of this material in the world doesn't show up, it definitely puts a crimp in your ability to control and better safeguard these materials. But there are many other key nations here that the security of whose arsenals are major problems, including Pakistan, who showed up today. Or Turkey doesn't have a nuclear arsenal but has a lot of material and is a very troubled nation, some would say, on the brink. So there's plenty of work to do. Not having Russia means we'll get less work done.
Well, without being facetious, Joe, Donald Trump the other day suggested that maybe South Korea and Japan should get nuclear weapons and carry their burden. It's pretty extraordinary that that kind of dialogue is happening in a presidential campaign in the face of Obama's efforts to secure loose nukes and loose nuclear material.
Well, you know, I've been critical of the pace of these nuclear summits. I wrote an article somewhat critical about this in Defense One yesterday, saying that they have to do more, they have to move faster, that the actions we're taking are not commensurate with the rising threat level. I do believe that the risk of nuclear terrorism is rising, but Obama is working at it. He is trying. He is pushing. Donald Trump is just a clown on this. I have an article coming out in Politico tomorrow called Trump's Nuclear Insanity. What he said casually, in sort of an off-the-cuff way, with on the CNN town hall with Anderson Cooper is that we should encourage Japan and South Korea and other countries, even Saudi Arabia, to get nuclear weapons. That this would be better. This would be a safer world, and we have to do this because North Korea's got nuclear weapons. For 70 years, there's been a bipartisan executive, congressional, civil, military consensus that we have to stop other countries from getting nuclear weapons, that we have to reduce the number of nuclear weapons. And it's worked. It's worked. It not always, but we have never encouraged a country to get a bomb. Not Israel, not France, not even the United Kingdom, who built the bomb with us in the Manhattan Project. So what Trump is doing is unprecedented in the nuclear age. And I don't think he even understands that.
Well, it's pretty hard to believe, though, that he hasn't noticed what just happened in Belgium and the fact that what's been revealed, the surveillance footage of a nuclear scientist who they're apparently planning on kidnapping, the fact that a guard at this big nuclear power plant in Molds in the north was murdered just a couple of days ago and his electronic pass was taken. It's not as if, nuclear power plants have nuclear fissile material, and there's a lot more of them around there. Nuclear weapons, we know, are pretty well guarded, but I don't think you can say the same for nuclear power plants. So the determination on the part of terrorists to get hold of not so much nuclear weapons but nuclear material for dirty bombs is manifestly clear.
Well, that is what sent chills down the spines of nuclear weapons experts all around the world. The news that the bombers, the same ISIS operatives who blew up the airport in Brussels, blew up the metro station in Brussels, had been videotaping the family of a Belgian official who worked at a nuclear plant that had these radiological materials that could be used for a dirty bomb. You don't know what they were doing. We don't know that. But the fact that they were doing it, that they were trying, that this was one of their possible operations, it's something, straight out of a Hollywood thriller. You can imagine a family kidnapped, held for blackmail, an official forced to do things to allow the terrorists access. If people think that sometimes we in the nuclear world are exaggerating these threats, are trying to scare people into eliminating nuclear weapons, no, these are real. These are real threats. And the rise of ISIS, the most well-funded, internationally networked, territory-holding terrorist group the world has ever seen, is why people think that the risk of global terrorism is on the rise. If they could get their hands on nuclear material, they would use it. So the answer is to stop them from getting their hands on the material, to lock it up, to secure it, to put it so far away from what the terrorists could do that you can prevent nuclear terrorism. We can do this. But that is not what Donald Trump is talking about. That is not. He's not talking about continuing these policies. He's talking about a mad, mad, mad nuclear world where everybody has bombs, where it's sort of a free market competition for bombs. It's crazy talk.
And again, I'm speaking with Joseph Cerincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. What came out in the trial, the Litvinenko trial in London, where eventually the finger was pointed back at the Kremlin as authors of the assassination of the former KGB operative who was killed with polonium? One of the more alarming things that came out in that case was revelations that Russian organized crime figures had sold arms to al-Qaeda and were negotiating to sell nuclear materials or even nuclear weapons. So the absence of Vladimir Putin is pretty conspicuous. I take it he's miffed about the sanctions against Ukraine. But what's your sense of how Russia is securing its it has greater stockpiles of I think both of nuclear weapons and certainly of nuclear materials?
Yeah, both the United States and Russia have about 7,000 nuclear weapons, and together we have about 95% of all the nuclear weapons that are in the world. So when people talk about this, we really have to focus on what the U.S. and Russia are doing. That's where most of the danger actually is. But the materials, Russia has actually larger stockpiles. They've been disassembling weapons, and they've just been storing the material. They continue to manufacture some of this material. They actually are trying to use plutonium as a fuel, so they're making more plutonium. And this is an economy in collapse. This is not Japan or Germany or even Turkey, for that matter. This is a troubled country, very corrupt, a sinking economy, especially particularly with the falling oil prices, one that feels threatened, or a paranoid leadership that has tried to crush human rights and democratic rights in Russia. So this is a problem state. I don't necessarily think it's going to always be that way. I think that the situations could turn so bad for Putin that he decides he has to make a strategic adjustment, that he has to try to reach an accommodation with the West, with the United States. He could decide that it's in his interest to reengage in nuclear cooperation. But right now we're in a very dangerous period where he's cut off cooperation. He's boycotting meetings like this. It's a danger. There's no question about it.
And let's turn. You mentioned Pakistan, Joseph Ancioni, and of course that is the toughest nut to crack, I would think. First of all, just in the last few days, where women and children were blown up at an amusement park on Easter Sunday, that would indicate to anybody that this is a government that cannot protect its own citizens from terrorism. And concurrent with the bombing of innocent people, mostly they were targeted as Christians, but actually mostly Muslims were killed. In the nation's capital, in Islamabad, there's 2,000 plus demonstrators were demonstrating to have the killer of a governor who had criticized the blasphemy laws which he used arbitrarily against Christians and others. He was murdered by a policeman who they want to declare as an official martyr. So the Taliban and these various other terrorist groups in Pakistan are so much more proactive than the government itself. So, and my understanding is that, the old joke is, of course, that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And they have control of these nuclear weapons, and they're building more and more of them. They're building faster than any other country on the earth, I believe, and they're building tactical nuclear weapons, battlefield ones to boot. Isn't that a form of blackmail that's going on with Pakistan? They're basically saying, you've got to support us because of nuclear terrorism. At the same time, rather than secure their arsenals and let us know how secure they are, they're building more nuclear bombs.
Pakistan is the most dangerous country on earth, and it's not because of their ethnic makeup. It's not because of their religion. It's because of this combination of risk factors. So while North Korea, for example, is dangerous, we can go off on that for a while, they have enough material for about 10 bombs. Pakistan has already built 100 nuclear weapons, has enough material for 100 more, as you say, is making more nuclear weapons faster than any country on earth, and is starting to make mobile, tactical nuclear weapons that would be dispersed to battlefield commanders. But it's got a collapsing economy, a corrupt government, jihadist influences in the military and in the intelligence apparatus, which opens up issues of what they call the insider threat, is their cooperation to help terrorist groups get nuclear weapons. Oh, and it shares a border with a nuclear-armed neighbor, India, with which it has fought four wars since independence. And it has al-Qaeda and the Taliban and ISIS operating within its national territory. I mean, this is a recipe for disaster. This is why nuclear experts, when we look at this, there's so many things we have to do just to get in a position to try to prevent a nuclear catastrophe that with Pakistan, that most prognoses for this country are rather grim, I think many people expect something terrible to happen in Pakistan.
Well, when Donald Trump suggested that even Saudi Arabia should have a nuclear weapon, and we were talking earlier with one of the people that featured in the PBS Frontline documentary last night.
Saudi,
I don't know whether you saw it, but it's just a shocking portrait through secret, surreptitiously filmed film inside a country, Saudi Arabia, that's an ally and that's arguably as repressive as North Korea. But there's a long-held belief that and that was one of the reasons why the deal with Iran was so important, that if Iran got a nuclear weapon, then the Saudis would simply go buy one from the Pakistanis.
Well, yes, I don't think it's that simple. And that would risk, of course, a complete diplomatic rupture on the part of Saudi Arabia and Pakistan with the United States, their biggest ally, their biggest supporter. Whatever differences they have with us, however much they sort of disdain us, we still are the biggest superpower in the world, and there's nobody else like us. So I think there's real barriers to them doing that. But yes, that is a risk. And I also agree with your larger point. I think we've given Saudi Arabia a free pass for way too long. Partially, it's because all the rhetoric has been focused on Iran. Iran, which does terrible things, its own government is repressive, and there's lots to criticize there. But compared to what? I mean, look at what Saudi Arabia does. They are equally, if in some ways, more repressive. They also execute people for non-violent crimes. They cut off people's hands. They crucify people. A routine form of execution in Saudi Arabia is execution. It's an astonishingly barbaric regime, but we count them as an ally. The fear is that barbarism at some point can no longer repress the people of Saudi Arabia, and a reckoning would come, spreading further a collapse throughout the Middle East.
So then,
well, this is a cheery conversation.
I know it is, but let me just in the last couple of minutes then try and focus in on what could possibly be done. And the more you point out what a challenge it is and how terrible these countries are, it occurs to me that at the end of the day, the only way that we're going to get rid of this problem is to have better governance. You can't rely on military despots or religious fanatics to secure nuclear weapons. Only a transparent and civilized, democratically run country can do that, surely.
Well, this is, if you read the interview with Obama in The Atlantic, this is kind of at the base of his thinking, that there are core problems in the Middle East, civilization problems, ethnic problems, tribal problems, conflicts that we cannot solve, and that our involvement in the Middle East actually makes things worse because we're propping up these unpopular repressive governments, whether it's Egypt or Saudi Arabia or others, and that our interests are best served by a gradual, careful, measured withdrawal from the Middle East, not further involvement, not more military bases, not more military conflict, but the withdrawal. And I agree with that. I agree with that. There are some profound problems. There is going to be instability in the Middle East for years to come, but it doesn't necessarily have to lead to global instability. It doesn't have to lead to a conflict between the great powers. It's something that, unfortunately, it's going to take a while for them to sort out. But you know what? European history took a while for us to sort out, and there were some very bloody conflicts, religious, ethnic, tribal conflicts in Europe. And we have to have I share Obama's view. It doesn't necessarily have to involve us.
Well, Joseph Rincione, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Rincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, the History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Governmental Operations, and served as a staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at IanMasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.